Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining us tonight we have Fine Gael TD for Carlow Kilkenny and Minister of State for Local Government and Electoral Reform, John Paul Phelan, Fianna Fáil TD for Wexford, Malcolm Byrne, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central, Breed Smith, Tanya Ward, CEO of the Children's Rights Alliance and journalist Lise Hand. We want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, today in the Dáil, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald quoted from 7-year-old Kevin Maughan's letter to Santa.
He writes to Santa, "Please come to my hotel again with Batman toys." That's what he wants this year. Kevin is 7. He lives in emergency accommodation in County Clare with his parents and his little sister.
I share your concern about children in the run-up to Christmas, concerned about whether Santa will be able to find them on Christmas Eve. And he will. And the same goes for kids in hospitals, and the same goes for kids in emergency accommodation or in hotels or at home with their parents.
And that was the Taoiseach speaking in the Dáil today. Now, tonight we are asking if the state is cherishing all of its children equally, because we've now had a slew of reports that have outlined how children in various settings are being failed by the state. We've had reports on children in emergency accommodation, children in direct provision, children living in communities where they're being used by drug gangs, children in homes where they're at risk of domestic violence. And all of the reports raise serious questions about our commitment to keeping all of these children safe. So first, I want to go to a position paper launched today by the Faculty of Paediatrics in the Royal College of Physicians on children in direct provision. Dr. Niamh O'Brien is one of the lead, or is the lead author of that report, and she joins me on the line now. Good evening, Niamh.
Good evening. How are you,
Niamh? This report. Can you tell me first, why did the Faculty of Paediatrics produce this position paper?
So I suppose we felt that this was a marginalised group of children in our society. They didn't really have a voice of their own, and we just had some concern from our own point of view, from their medical health, and it's also been raised by other professional groups such as the College of Psychiatry in the past. We just felt, as physicians looking after these children, that we wanted to advocate for them and potentially to just, you know, advise society as a whole of the problems that they were having.
And some of the findings, I mean, it's a short enough document, but some of the findings are really stark. I mean, one of the ones that jumped out at me was about mothers feeding their infant babies.
Yeah, so it's really inadequate for all families living in DP at the moment, and it doesn't really give them the chance to just be a family and have their normal family supports. Feeding, nutrition is a big concern as well.
Yeah, I see. Hostels provided no baby food and many of the family's cash supplements were spent on baby-related items. There was a line as well, inadequate nutrition meant that breastfeeding mothers often had to switch to formula feeding after a few weeks, putting further financial strain on the family.
Yeah, and the financial situation has slightly improved in that they now have just under €30 per week per child, just under €40 per week per adult, but this was increased this year. Previously, it had just been €22 per child. So really, their financial supports are very inadequate, but they still feel they have to use these to supplement what the state is providing them with.
One of the big issues, of course, is a lot of these families have come from, have experienced serious trauma in their country of origin. There are issues there to begin with, but that the situation we're placing them in for long periods of time is causing further trauma.
That's definitely the case. So 94% are reporting that they've already experienced traumatic events prior to coming to Ireland. They have about 10 times the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, 3 times the rate of psychosis in the general population. So you might have a child and a parent who are both affected by this. So, and with the current state of our psychological services, this means that just everyone's really exposed to a lot of stress and we don't have the services to deal with it. Also, they're often put in small peripheral rural communities where the local medical services are just expected to absorb kind of the added burden that these people bring, both medically and psychologically, and they don't get any additional resources to do that. That also places a strain on the medical and social services in these areas.
And the figures are really stark. 14% of children in direct provision are referred to social services. That's pretty shocking.
Yeah, so they're 8 times more likely than the general population to be referred to TUSLA. So some of the issues are including problems with supervision. So they often, there's just one adult and they might not be able to look after or supervise children all at one time. proximity of unknown adults is a very big issue. So often you have unknown adults, unknown single men sharing accommodation with families. In some of the reports written by children on their own experiences, this was raised as a frequent concern, and they often felt unsafe. Many young teenage girls felt like they couldn't really be teenagers, they couldn't dress up, they couldn't put on makeup because they were fearful of these unknown adults. That's definitely a big concern. They're also overrepresented in injuries and burns in admissions to hospitals as well.
Yeah, that again, of course, it does make sense that scalding injuries are something you're seeing a lot of in emergency rooms.
Yeah, so that's usually due to unsafe, kind of overcrowded home environments is the most likely cause for increasing that, and that's what we're seeing.
And ultimately, I mean, I suppose your main recommendation out of this position paper is that, you know, own door accommodation is vital for all these families.
That would be ideal. Obviously, that's difficult and will cost money. But in the interim, before that would be happening, it would be really ideal to stop having to segregate families and have family only versus single adult accommodation. Another big issue is the educational aspect. So these children can go to school, they can go to primary and secondary school, but then they can't do anything once they finish their leaving cert. There's been some reports of children choosing to repeat their leaving certificate because they've nothing else to do. They haven't been previously allowed to work, and they still don't have asylum. So that's just a big pity as well. Really, they should be allowed to access third level education and have their fees waived.
And there's even just more basic recommendations involving like vaccination programs, because a lot of these children are not up to date with vaccinations. Like
no, 60% wouldn't be up to date, and the state will only pay for catch up vaccines up to 12 years, and also the psychological services as well. There's also a big problem with the children that they often have to act as translators for their parents, so they really need to have more translational support to allow them to kind of deal with or interact with the services that they're entitled to.
Okay, and ultimately you say it needs to end, that this entire system needs to be brought to an end.
Basically, this entire system is depriving children of their childhood. We know that children with inadequate housing have a 25% increase in physical and mental health, and really as a history of a country with significant harm done to children in institutional care, we really need to be looking at what we're doing. And in the years to come, people will probably look back on this as we have done with other institutional scandals previously.
Indeed. Dr. Niamh O'Brien, I'll let you go. Thank you for giving us that insight into that position paper that was released today by the Royal College of Physicians. Tanya Ward, you visited a number of direct provision centres, and I know you've said before that the human rights abuses you witnessed in some of these centres were probably some of the worst you've ever seen.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was really part when I was on the government working group in 2014, 2015, that was looking at direct provisions called the McMahon Group. And we travelled around to direct provision centres around the country. And what was really interesting is actually there's such huge variation. So you go to one centre, there's really poor interactions between the staff and the children and the adults. I mean, one of the ones I was really shocked about was the adults were quite mean to the children. The children talked about how they never had a smoothie before, and they saw the adults making a smoothie in the kitchen. And the kids saw it, they slammed the door. And just before we arrived...
You're talking about the adults' staff or the adults?
The staff running the centre.
Right.
And just before we arrived at the centre, they opened up a children's room, you know, with tiny little chairs. And, you know, we asked, so, you know, what have we shown here? I think we showed Frozen last week, so clearly they had just set up all these things because we were going off investigating them.
That is so reminiscent of the stories you hear back from the mother and baby home days,
right,
where children were dressed up when the inspectors were coming.
That's right. But then you went to another centre and it was a completely different situation where the kitchen was open all day, the children were happy with the food, the centre manager had a good relationship with the residents and with the children. And that's what was really staggering, that we didn't have any way of standardising the system that we were providing. We were putting a lot of money into this system and actually we were looking for very little in return from the people providing for it. One of the other things that was staggering was I expected going around that parents would talk about, you know, the other adults in the centre, and that was their child protection risk. But parents would say, no, I am the child protection risk. My mental health is breaking down. And a lot of those cases that HICWA identified, that where children had been referred to TUSLA, it was actually the mental health of the parent was breaking down because they had spent so long in direct provision and they themselves had come from a situation where they had been subjected to human rights abuses. Now, saying all of that, there actually has been some positive improvements over the last couple of years. One of the things that's changed is the direct provision payment, the weekly payment that children were getting. When we visited those centres, children were only getting 960 a week. They were getting their food and their board, but 960 a week. What parents would say is that I have to make a decision. Do I buy a bottle of Calpol or send my child to a hurling club? Kind of decisions that no parent should have to make, and was breaking their heart not to send their child to the local hurling club. And it's been 15 years that the direct provision payment had not been increased. So that has been increased.
What is it now?
It's 29.80. So increased per child. So the first increase was Joan Burton and then Leah Radker and then Regina Doherty did the third increase. And that makes a big difference because I met teenagers around the same time as well. One of them talked about how she just didn't have the money for shampoo. So she was using this generic shampoo from the bathroom and her hair was in bits from it. And she said she'd go to school and she was just ashamed. And that's the thing when you live in poverty. It's those little things that have a huge effect on you and how you think about yourself.
And socially, of course.
Absolutely.
And in school settings.
And the thing I think when we look at direct provision and homeless situations, and this is why own door accommodation is so key, it's living in an institutional setting for a period of time. That's where the difficulty arises, I think, because the people running the centres become very institutionalised, and then the people living in the centres become very institutionalised as well. And the way to remedy that is to have own door accommodation. And here is the thing, the Department of Justice has spent 2 years working on national standards as a result of the McMahon Group that calls for own door accommodation for families. So the government is moving in that direction. The key now is actually providing the accommodation and putting that in place, and also providing for independent inspections, because those national standards won't be realised unless you have someone like HICWA coming in and checking that they're being fulfilled.
Yeah, Breed Smith, that there has been improvements in that as well, though, because the Ombudsman for Children has now got a role in relation to children in direct provision centres, which hadn't been there before.
Sorry, but my understanding is, Tanya mentioned it there, that when they went on visits, it was like they were prepared for them. My understanding is that the Ombudsman also will alert the centres to when the visits are taking place.
So you need to have spot checks.
You need to have spot checks. The other part of this is a very important bit of it, is that this service is entirely privatised. It's outsourced and privatised. So
there's a lot of money being spent.
A lot of money being made. Yeah. There's a lot of profit being made. And applying national standards to privatised system is very, very difficult. And I do honestly believe that it should be taken into public control. And the standards that we would apply to a children's hospital or a school that we would demand through the public sector should be applied and adhered to. And the idea that until that happens, that visits are forewarned and that they're, you know, the preparedness of the centres to pretend that they're delivering the service, they're able to hoodwink the, in the case that Tanya talked about, the visitors who were reporting on it, or in the future, the Ombudsman.
I know. Well, I'm actually reading here what John O'Donoghue said when direct provision was set up as a stopgap, as everyone remembers, 19 years ago. And he said the ideal way to support asylum seekers was through permanently build accommodation, which would be constructed as quickly as possible and house 4,000 people. 19 years later, John Paul Phelan, where are these permanently built structures that are housing our asylum seekers?
Yeah, well, I suppose a lot has happened in the 19 years. I'd like to ask John, I don't know where they are, but some of them are being built. What we've seen recently, following on...
We haven't actually built any, though, have we?
Ballinamore is an example of one where own door provision, though, has improved significantly.
And that's Ballinamore's own door provision, yeah.
The issue, I suppose, is rubber hits the road in local communities. I mean, my local area that I come from, actually part of it's in Wexford and part of it's in Kilkenny, and we were the home for a direct provision centre 19 years ago, one of the first ones. It's not anymore. But there was a real, it actually worked very well in the local community. What Tanya says is right. There's a need for uniform standards. I don't agree with Breed that, like, we have uniform standards in things like nursing homes and other privately run. We do, and HICWA are in there. In that example, you can have uniform standards in privately run facilities, but there's a huge. I accept, and there's a couple of particular black spot provision centres. We have a situation where we still have...
Say that and that's acknowledged. And I think everyone is aware of that. And if anyone follows the Massey Twitter account, you will see scarifying stories being told about individual interactions and difficulties in particular centres. But even on a general view, if I can quote from Niamh O'Brien there that we just spoke to from that report, where she said, as a country with such a significant history of harm done to children in institutional care, it's regrettable we seem to have not learned from our past experiences. Our system of placing children in direct provision is unethical, stigmatising and needs to end.
The biggest change that's happened in this government's 8 years is the reduction in time that people are experiencing for making their application. There's been actually, there was a period I think where the average was 7, 8, 9 years in some instances. Certainly that was the case in the provision centre that I knew most clearly in my own area. Those waiting times have changed dramatically. We've also made the first steps in terms
I'm sure you're right in some cases, but very recently when we were covering this in the studio, we were hearing about people who were waiting 6 months up to a year for their first initial interview to get into the system, and they're spending that time in one of these centres.
And 8 or 9 years ago, they were waiting years for it. I mean, I'm not saying that 6 months is enough. But I am saying that it has moved substantially in the right direction.
Does that not clearly indicate there's something fundamentally wrong?
There is, yeah. But I mean, how do we deal, though, with the classic Irish situation of NIMBYism?
Let me give you a text that just came in. Katie, it's beyond time we got real about RTÉ's fixation with direct provision. Every day we're being bombarded with the same propaganda. Where exactly are we supposed to house these economic migrants? We can't house our own people, says Michael. Now, of course, people who are asylum seekers are not.
We've had really good examples like Balhadrine, like the Bursacane situation at the moment, like even very recently in Macroom, where they set up their committee before the residents of the direct provision centre arrived.
But is this just going to roll on, John Paul Phelan? Because there is a sense now that certainly in the last 6 months, the people are engaging on both sides of this in a way that people hadn't engaged before. People are engaging in communities demanding that, you know, that these centres are not being brought into their communities. And I think people are engaging as well and actually seeing what is going on in direct provision and are pretty appalled that we are keeping in particular children in these situations. I mean, the idea that any child would be at that much at risk of simple things like a scalding injury.
We have to continue the investment in the own door provision. That was Brian McMahon and that group's main recommendation. And that's where Charlie Flanagan's national standards come into play. And we don't have that at present. And that's what presents particularly difficult situations. But it has moved substantially in the right direction in the last few years.
Would you agree with that, Malcolm Byrne?
Well, I don't. And I think what we need to look at, you know, the focus here is why are we... you know, why do we have the direct provision centres? What's our moral obligation here? And what we're talking about is children at risk. And when we listened to Dr. Niamh O'Brien, she spoke about 94% of those children have already experienced trauma. Now, I've spoken to some of the children, some of the teenagers who've come here, who've gone to school in Ireland. What people, I think, really need to think about is, you know, why are they here? No mother or father is going to, you know, put their child on a boat to leave their home country willingly. These are children who, if you talk to them, they've often lost members of their own family, they've lost their friends, they've lost their home, their entire environment. And I think if people think in that context about, you know, their own teenage years or their own teenage kids, if those kids were to lose everything, the situation that they would face. So they've already experienced, as Dr. Niamh O'Brien had said, in many cases, incredible trauma. when they've got here. The difficulty has been the length of time. And again, we're talking about, you know, kids who've been through the school system. In my role, I worked with the Higher Education Authority prior to my election.
We've heard a lot about kids who, you know, do so well, put their head down, get good leaving certs.
Kids do extraordinarily well. They go through the school system. They get a really good leaving certificate. They apply the same way as everyone else applies for a third level place. The problem is they're classified as international students. That means that they are not entitled to, in inverted commas, free fees, the subsidy of the state. They have to pay the full fee. They're not entitled to apply for a SUSE grant. What I will say is a lot of the higher education institutions, a lot of the universities have been very supportive. Universities have declared themselves...
But surely it shouldn't be down to individual universities
There has to be a very clear policy that needs to be put in place. Now, the ideal solution is that if somebody comes here... Very quickly their claim is processed, there's obviously a difference between asylum seekers and economic migrants, but I think, you know, for anybody in Ireland to criticise economic migrants, I think they're very short sighted. The problem, and that text that you read kind of reflects, you know, this bigger challenge that. People often use the line, you know, how are we meant to house these people when we can't house our own? That to me is a reflection of problems with regard to the housing crisis. I think overwhelmingly Irish people are generous. They understand some of the challenges that are there. They know, you know, that people who are coming from...
Now you have just been through a by-election where another candidate from another party made some very controversial remarks about asylum seekers. And migrants into this country, and she got a very, very significant vote.
But
nine and a half thousand.
Yeah, I don't think with respect to that. I mean, the first thing I'd say is that immigration did not feature as an issue in the by-election. It doesn't feature as an issue.
It was the only issue
that the media were obsessed about.
But I
can tell you on the grounds.
People consume media.
People do, but the issues that were coming up during the by-election were around housing and health and mental health and those provisions. In the context of where it comes up,
you're saying nobody in Wexford.
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. Okay. And I think it's also about. This is a relatively wealthy country, and some of the challenges that we face. I mean, where we saw the protests in Uachtaráin and so on. That they're not the people in Uachtaráin, for instance, are not racist. The people in Uachtaráin are concerned about the lack of resources and facilities within their community.
Okay. I just want to give you another text.
All of these problems.
So I got another one which refers to that point. As Dr. Niamh O'Brien noted amongst her other findings, direct provision occurs in small rural communities with little way of backup. It's very telling that there are no direct provision centres in the low, even-numbered Dublin postcodes where the best facilities in the entire state exist. I just want to bring Lise into it. I mean, is there an issue that it... There are no votes in direct provision, or certainly on one side of direct provision.
Well, I think, that is the bottom line. There are no votes in direct provision because you have a government and successive governments that shy away from the issue. They are reactive rather than proactive. They don't take any leadership in it. When a kerfuffle happens or something bad happens, they scramble to... You know, to put a patch on it. So, you know, instead of taking leadership of this and saying, look, we're going to actually put a plan in place. So if we are going to open a direct provision centre somewhere, we're going to roll out a programme of information beforehand, get the community involved, let them know what's going on. We're going to put a structure in place where there are medical supports, where there are education supports, if it means changing, you know, things like SUSE grants.
That all sounds very expensive, Lise.
You see, this is it, and it sounds expensive. And the first text you had there, mm-hmm. The trouble is it is completely entangled with the fact that there are almost 4,000 children in the state living in homelessness, and the two get conflated. So instead of actually saying this is a human rights issue, this is actually, these people are like our refugees, they get tangled up with the complete homeless problem, and And people just can't see their way out of that. It's, you know, it's a lot of it is just the messages are completely wrong.
Okay, I want to move on, but you wanted to get...
I think one of the main reasons why you haven't seen reform over the years and you're starting to see it now is, you know, the general thinking was if we make conditions too good here, we'll get more people. The pull factor. Well, in actual fact, though, if you look at the evidence of why people decide to travel to a country, it's because a human trafficker has found a way into the country. And often people would arrive here and not know they're in Ireland, or they're arriving... They're coming because they already have a family member here. And a prime example of this is, if you remember the children in Calais who were in France, we said we'd take 200. When the Department of Children officials and TUSLA went over to try and find children to come to Ireland, they didn't want to come. They wanted to go to the UK. And they did, you know, take around 44 over to Ireland. But the majority of them wanted to go to the UK because they have family members there. And that's the thing. I think we have to get real about why people flee their country and why they arrive. And to your caller, to your texter who was saying, why should we play a role here? I mean, the truth is we only see a drop in the ocean when it comes to refugees. Mm-hmm. We're an island at the edge of Europe. We never will see the full numbers of refugees that arrive in mainland Europe. We have a small role to play, but we have an important role to play.
But it's also nearly 20 years, Katie, since you refer to the remarks of John O'Donoghue. And that generation are now really starting to have an impact. Like, my wife is from Leitrim and they got to the hurling final, the Laurie Mar, and this Zach Mouradi, who she's always talking about, and he was a Kurdish refugee in direct provision. And so there is a generation. I think I slightly disagree
Look what we're doing to that generation, Jean-Paul Phelan. If we're denying them places in third level, we're putting a ceiling on how far they can integrate and be part and move ahead.
And many of them do get places in third level, but it is on an ad hoc
I want to address and directly address the texter who said, why should we look after these economic migrants when we can't look after our own, in reference to the homeless? And they have a point insofar as what they're hitting out at is the idea that we can't look after 4,000 children or over 10,000 in total and homeless. I don't accept that. This is an extremely wealthy country, one of the fastest growing economies in Europe. There's gross inequality, and we'll see more of it evidenced when we come to the other reports you listed. Gross inequality and human rights violations of children, both in homelessness, in our communities, in all sorts of ways. And we can look after everybody if we end the inequality that exists and stop pampering the tiny few at the top, whether it's vulture funds or developers or builders. So when people find it easy to kick out at people in direct provision or to vent their anger on them, they really need to look above them and look at the government and look at the system that is running this inequality and presiding over it. And I understand why it always seems easier to blame the other, the stranger that comes into the country, but actually it's those that are running the country that we should be venting our ire on and putting our demands to.
Well, can I just say, I just had a note in from Cian McCormack, who's of course the Morning Ireland reporter. He was down in Wexford vox popping for the election, and he said the immigration issue was arising unprompted alongside the issue of jobs. He said he was really gobsmacked by the fact that people were raising it and prepared to record it for the radio, and he says your contributor says it was not an issue on the ground and he found the opposite. Were you talking to the people down there at all, Malcolm?
Well, I clearly think I was talking to the people given that they elected me, and certainly I think that it's incumbent on all of us who are involved in politics to stand it up. I'm not saying that it's not an issue. But I think that in terms of
that
big issues
that are
there, that must
have been the South Wexford gang, was it?
No, I'm not all. And Breda's right in the sense that
to be facetious because it is a very
but
serious
there
issue.
There is a question about the kind of the vision that we're going to have for this country that goes into the future. And you mentioned about cherishing all the children of the nation equally. You know, over 100 years after we had that. I mean, one thing I'm very conscious about...
Okay, I know you are very conscious of a lot of stuff, Malcolm, but we do need to move on.
But that's why I want to talk about other issues apart from why there is a media obsession about trying to raise, and particularly in the Wexford context, around immigration, when as a county, we're a lot more tolerant than most. You know, we're a county of Normans and Vikings, and I think trying to reflect this view that there's an obsession in Wexford with this issue, that's not the case.
Okay. Children in gangs, because we had another report today. This one was carried out by Johnny Connolly of the Centre of Crime, Justice and Victim Studies at UL, and that looked at criminal networks in areas between the Liberties and Walkinstown in Dublin South inner city. And it found that children as young as 10 or 11, many of whom are still in primary school, are being groomed by the gangs there to be runners and carriers of drugs and drug money, and are considered to be both expendable and plentiful. Breed Smith, you were actually interviewed for in the early stages of this report.
Well, I was part of a community discussion for it when Johnny first started doing his research in the South Inner City. This Dublin South Central is my constituency, and I was at the launch of the report this morning. But some things do jump out at me, but I do need to start by saying that he found that throughout the whole constituency, the average of the numbers in the community involved in these networks, I think you prefer to call them criminal networks rather than gangs, is about 1.2% of the entire population.
It's so absolutely, yeah, very important to say that, because you do not want to stigmatise an entire community because these criminal networks have embedded themselves.
I think this is an amazing graphic. He has a tree with the plant above it and the roots underneath it, and he looks at where this comes from: lack of opportunity, economic mobility and social capital, poor housing quality and affordability, violence, community disruption, discrimination and poverty at the root. And then through their lives, as you go up the tree, these young kids are experiencing periods of homelessness, incarceration, mental illness, divorce, emotional and mental neglect, maternal depression, emotional and sexual abuse, substance abuse, and it goes on. So there is a picture here of how, when you look as well as the map he made out of the levels of deprivation in different parts of South Central as against other parts of South Central which have a high degree of affluence, where these networks are strongest and operate is where the deprivation is rooted. And that's an important point to make, because his conclusions are important insofar as he says it has to be grounded in human rights considerations, and the responses have to be delivered through coherent, locally orientated, community safety first approaches. And what he means by that is that all of the networks in the community, whether they're family services, youth services, drug task forces, and the local policing fora, which are community based fora, need to have a strategy where they work together. But what we're finding increasingly, and even last week news came to us, is that funding is being withdrawn from many of the drugs task force projects. And we now have a situation in the canal communities where the HSE are trying to directly fund addiction services rather than working with the community services and the family resource services that currently exist. If we bypass them, we're not going to deal with the roots of Johnny Connolly's tree. Need to have a holistic approach.
Yeah, John Paul Phelan, wasn't this exactly what I think it was nine former ministers of state that had responsibility for the drug strategy came out together and said they have serious, serious concerns with how the drug strategy is now working, and for exactly the reason that Breed outline there, is that the community-based approach that had served them well up to now seems to be disintegrating.
Yeah, well, there's a review, and I know it's been going on for a few years, of the funding of the drugs task forces across the country. I mean, I was struck by the nine, I think they were all bar Éan Riordan, I think Fianna Fáil, former drugs ministers.
Roisin Shortall was there, Pat Rabbit was there. I mean, they weren't all Fianna Fáil. This was a cross-party group of ministers.
Pat Rabbit was never a minister for drugs.
Pat was one of those who made...
No, I'm not with the picture.
Very critical of the approach that has been taken.
I'd be critical enough too, in the sense that when John Corn was the last minister before Fianna Fáil abolished the position, when Brian Cowan became Taoiseach in those years. Actually, I googled tonight just to do a little bit of research on John Corn. His bill, I accept it, and the government accepts it.
We should just say John Corn introduced a bill yesterday.
He was Minister for Drugs for 2 years.
Just explain what that bill would do. It's
essentially aimed at the abuse of children. So John introduced the Misuse of Drugs Amendment Bill, and there was a good discussion in the Dáil this evening. Yeah. It essentially does two things. It makes it a criminal offence to purchase drugs from somebody who's under the age of 18, and also it's a criminal offence
to cause a child to purchase drugs. It's a much more direct sanction.
The issue that I would have is that in his 2 years as Minister for Drugs, he didn't produce a single piece of legislation. There was a report done in 2008.
Do we not have enough legislation? No. Is legislation really the answer here? Is it not more what we're talking about?
In 2008, there was a report done
at community level in UCC.
Dr. Niamh Horgan did a report on drug gangs in Limerick. It was in the South Hill, some of the more deprived parts, which a lot of them have been redeveloped since. And it showed that children as young as 3 and 4 were involved in the intimidatory tactics of some of the drugs gangs in Limerick at the time. Deputy Curran was the Minister for Drugs at the time, didn't take any action on the particular report. So I think there's a little bit of politicking.
Was there not an enormous job of work done in Limerick in terms of...
Absolutely. But there was no legislation introduced by him when he was the Minister.
He didn't need legislation, obviously. There was an extraordinary turnaround of
because there was a buy-in by the local community and Dennis Brosnan.
Isn't that the point we're trying to make?
This is the problem, John Paul, and Breed is correct on this, is because... And it applies across all areas, both in terms of the drug task force or any engagement with young people, is that power has been taken away from the communities. This was the point that Pat Rabbit has been making, which the former drugs ministers have been making. And there's an obsession, I think, around government as well, around centralising all powers, taking it away from the community.
Let him finish his point, and then you can respond. It's stated, and this is very like the direct provision debate we had earlier on, stated an agreed policy by all of the major political parties and independents and groups about one of the aspects of dealing with the drug situation is the criminality end of it. One that we also accept is that there's a whole medical, if you like, and rehabilitation aspect. At the moment, we have the Fianna Fáil Deputy Lord Mayor of Dublin leading the opposition to the injection centre that was proposed and was policy of the HSE for treatment of drug addicts in the centre of Dublin.
And I'll put that to Malcolm Horne in a minute. But just three weeks ago, we learned that. Excuse me, John Paul, in relation to that exact point, didn't we learn just 3 weeks ago that the Finance Minister, Pascal Donoghue, had raised concerns about a Simon community home for rehabilitated drug addicts in his area.
Yeah.
So this is not something that is exclusive to.
Yeah, but as I understand, that was provided in his area. The issue.
No, it wasn't provided. It disappeared that week. The plan was changed. It was turned into something else that week.
But it moved to. It's still provided in that part of the city. The service was still provided. The issue is that it, and I agree with a lot of what Malcolm says, but it's grand to have national policies to support an issue. But when your local councillors do the exact opposite.
This is about empowering local communities to be able to provide services within their area. And it was Breed's point earlier in that the local task forces, you talk to local youth services, power has been taken away and been centralising. You're Minister for Local Government. I mean, I'll make the point, you haven't devolved a single power since you became Minister for Local Government. No, sorry. If you're Minister for Local Government, you should be looking about... tell us about what powers, because you actually haven't...
The rates alleviation schemes for the first time ever.
Speaking of fake news,
I just have a quote.
It's just
in.
Blatant lies.
I just have a quote in relation to that Simon Residential Recovery Service. A quote from Pascal Donoghue. I understand in his letter to residents in his area, I understand arising from the engagement of both state agencies, Dublin Simon agreed not to proceed with a proposed residential recovery service. John Paul Fielden.
Yeah. No, you're going all quiet, John. Yeah. Come on, you've been shouting and roaring for the last half an hour.
Well, they agreed not to provide it then. I thought it was
on foot of a letter from the Minister for Finance, which I'm sure would put the fear of God into any...
I don't think it was on foot of a letter.
It was a letter to his
constituents about it. Isn't that what he said?
No, but he had raised the concerns with Simon himself.
Yeah, these things are moved, but they're provided.
Well, you were up on a very high horse there a few minutes ago about Fianna Fáil mayor objecting to injection centres.
Yeah.
So it's what sauce for the goose, surely?
No, well, I'm familiar enough with the provision of homelessness services, and there's always a question. There was an argument a few weeks ago about one of the hostel on, is it Wexford Street, where there was a proposal, I think, by the department to provide it into a homeless shelter. That was changed because of local interaction with the community there. They decided, Dublin City Council, not to progress with it. But I do think, like, my issue is that if you're going to make a political argument about lack of support at government level, while you're one of your most senior local government members completely flies in the face of what you're talking about at national level, that's not...
I think it's a shame to allow a discussion around this very, very important piece of work, which is a template that could be provided to all community across Ireland, is breaking down into a political spat between the two of you. There's so much more to talk about in it, and I think...
Tanya... take on what the initial steps, because this is obviously an atrocious situation to allow children growing up into this scenario.
That's right. I mean, it's kind of devastating because once you're sucked in by these gangs...
And a lot of them are family-based gangs as well. Right. So, I mean, how do you...
Their parents, their aunts, their uncles sometimes, I mean, these children are living in serious deprivation. As Breed said, you're talking about them being given these opportunities they've never had. You know, the best pair of runners that some might have in a classroom, getting to go on trips for the first time. How you address that and how you take away the carrot is you go in and try and address the serious deprivation that the families are living in and that the children are living in themselves. I mean, there's over 100,000 children living in consistent poverty at the moment. And this means these are children who are going to bed maybe hungry several times a week. They don't have a coat, you know, every September. They don't go to birthday parties. Their parents are living in very stressful situations. And these kind of children are living in this kind of poverty. But how they've cracked it, and I think what's really clever about the report is it's actually very manageable to address, because they say this is happening in very discreet locations. There are hotspots of activity, and there's very clear ways we can go in and address it. And one of the ways you can break a criminal network is intelligence. That's actually always how they've been broken in the past. And what they say in these communities, what's happening is there isn't a great relationship between the community and the Gardaí. The guards don't come when there's antisocial behaviour, so people don't call them anymore. People are afraid to call the guards because of the operation of these criminal networks. So the guards need to get in there and build their relationship back in the community, but they also need to rely on the community on intelligence, because they have the good soft intelligence. They can tell you exactly what's happening. I mean, we've heard from our member organisations, they've told me in Ballymun exactly where it's happening, they've told me in Dublin 8 exactly where it's happening. The guards should be able to operate on that information, and if I was in government, it's something I would focus on. I would zone in on these hotspots and break up these criminal networks and try and free these children to give them some sort of chance into the future.
At least.
Well, I mean, we've saw, you know, what the guards can do and the intelligence forces when they even work, say, something like with the PSNI over the Kevin Lunny case, when you had gangs operating with complete impunity, a community in fear. And then when something extraordinary happened, they were able to go in and actually act in an effective way. So we know that this is doable, that, you know, when the political will is there, that things can be done.
Political
will doesn't seem to be there. And I mean, you see a government that was being whaled upon, you know, in the Dáil today on several issues to do with children. I mean, we also had Micheál Martin bringing up the waiting list, hospital waiting list, 214,000 children waiting for healthcare.
The energy poverty report, the report.
I mean, it's endless, and it builds into a narrative where that they are a heartless government that don't care, that they think that suffer little children is actually a command. So, you know, to change, even just from the cynical political, you know, viewpoint, with an election looming, you know, you don't want, a government does not want to be going out, and this is just being cynical about it, going out on the doors with all these unresolved issues to do with the young, with the vulnerable in the state, whether they're in direct provision or whether they're living in hostels or emergency accommodation. So unless maybe the thought, you know, will concentrate minds a possible plebiscite coming up might concentrate minds. That, you know, and rightly, as Tanya said, there, some of these things are doable and fixable. You know, it's not, you know, this isn't some amorphous problem. I mean, the homeless problem is proving intractable, but something like this, they can actually do something about it. So I don't know whether the political will to do this is there or not.
I think this comes back, Kate, and the point I was making around, you know, the 1916 vision. And people will remember Enda Kenny's famous phrase about that. He wanted to make Ireland the best little small country in the world in which to do business. I think the challenge for us, and it's for all of us, is to make this the best little country in the world in which to have a childhood and in which to receive an education.
You know, Finland is somewhere where we can certainly look at. There are things in Ireland that we do well, you know, that we should set out. I'm very conscious, and this was, I suppose, the reference to 1916. I mean, one really interesting statistic is 1 in 5 babies who are born this year will live to the age of 100. You know, so the kids we're talking about now, many of them are going to see into the 2100s. They're going to be facing, as I would see, two of the biggest changes over the next decade, dealing with climate change plus the technological revolution. So, and this is our challenge about a vision, is how do we look at putting in place those long-term political policies?
Okay, I'm going to have to move on.
Can I make one last point very quickly. This isn't just about policing and it's not just about justice. In the same areas, you have another report of children growing up in the cold.
There's a lack of affordability
The Vincent DePaul report. It's gone very much under the radar, but it's quite shocking. You have other reports that you referenced at the start. We have a lack of intervention for kids with special needs. Assessments and needs is in a chronic state in Dublin South Central. There's hundreds of kids waiting for a long time just to have their special needs assessed. So there's a holistic approach that has to be taken, and there's an attempt to silence the community development sector. And I don't care what you say from Fine Gael's end, there is an attempt to silence them and to shift them sideways.
Dr. Connolly
doesn't want to see that, but he acknowledges that it's happening.
His report and his interview on Morning Ireland this morning, he was at pains. He was part of the Commission on the Future of Policing. He was at pains to find out his support for the bill that the government are drafting at the moment in relation to policing and community safety, which the heads are due to be published at the start of the new year. I mean, even his recommendations are placed in the context of the report on the future of policing in Ireland. It
not
can be achieved. It's not just about policing. No, I agree with you fully. Okay. But
I've got a tweet here from Maurice Quinlivan, your colleague in the Dáil. Read drugs and Limerick. This government and previous governments, drugs and alcohol task forces had their funding cut every year between 2008 and 2014, 50% in the Midwest.
Children of austerity is what we're seeing, really.
Yes, I agree with tackling the root problem, says another texter, in conjunction with throw away the key sentences for drug gangs. I'm far from a lefty supporter, says another texter, and used to be a Fine Gael voter, but it's so true now that Fine Gael's whole ethos is to look to big business, multinationals, the bankers, and put all the burden on ordinary working citizens. Varadkar's government lost my vote, so roll on the election ASAP. And one for you, Malcolm, the Normans and Vikings were invaders, not economic migrants,
Our history is quite mixed. There we have to take
a break, but stay with us because we want to talk about Dara Murphy and the Dáil Printer after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back in studio tonight. We have Fine Gael Minister of State, John Paul Phelan, Fianna Fáil's Malcolm Byrne, People Before Profits' Breed Smith, and journalist Lise Hand, Tanya Ward of the Children's Rights Alliance has left us at this stage. Just one final email we've got in on that discussion we've just had. Katie, I listened to the report on Morning Ireland this morning in relation to young children being groomed by criminal gangs. As a teacher who has worked in disadvantaged areas all my career for over 40 years, all I can say is this is a surprise to anyone. This situation has been the case for generations at this stage. I am weary from statutory agencies rebranding themselves and working with only a targeted group because of their caseloads, while schools have to deal with the needs of every child who comes through their doors. Happy Christmas from Anne. OK, we want to move on. Because now the search for an appropriate body to investigate the Dara Murphy affair continues apace, having ruled out the Oireachtas Ethics Committee, the Committee on Procedures and Privileges, and today the Clerk of the Dáil. The Finance Minister, Pascal Donoghue, has said he would work with Leinster House authorities to address this matter. Lise, would I be very cynical if I had the thought that perhaps Fine Gael are hoping to get out the gap for the Christmas break and that this will...
I think they are very much so. I mean, you know, how do you solve a problem like Dara Murphy? With great difficulty, it seems. I mean, the book passing has, you know, reached such speedy levels. You know, the sonic boom can be heard over Leinster House these days. I mean, it is quite extraordinary where, you know, they tried to give it to the Standards and Public Office and they were like, no, it's not our problem. The Ethics Committee, no. The Clerk of the Dáil, who's enough on his plate, God love him, what with all the kerfuffle over the printer, the Oireachtas printer, he's like, no, not my bailiwick either. So we are now left with a rather farcical
but
situation.
Who are these Leinster House authorities that the finance minister is now going to?
Well, you see, this is the Bertie Ahern something, someone should do something about this sort of scenario. And you have a scenario which I actually laughed out loud when I read this today, that the ethics, the Erectus Committee on Members' Interests has been requested by Fianna Fáil to formally look into this. However, it's reported that that committee can only conduct an investigation into his attendance and expenses if he himself requests an inquiry to be carried out. Now, I think it might be a cold day in hell before we see a letter from any TD requesting that any committee would look into anything of their affairs. So that looks like another dead end as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a case of stumbling to the end of the year and hoping somehow that events, dear boy, will overtake it and, you know, it will disappear quietly into the ether.
And yet the Taoiseach still robustly defending Darren Murphy, from what I can see, saying that he was entitled to take up that job, that he was well aware he was doing it, and that he, as far as he can see, didn't break any rules because, and this is the thing I want to ask you, John Poffey, he said he attended the Dáil on 120 days last year. How do we define attended now?
Well, actually, there was a survey done during the Votegate incident a month ago, or never it was. And the interesting thing about it is Darren Murphy wasn't bottom of the list in terms of attendance for Dáil votes. And they're not the phony Fianna Fáil type where you can be outside the door and someone else votes for you. He was physically in the chamber for votes. So, I mean, I think there is a broader issue. And obviously that threw up questions about certain independents and their low voting records, even though they're very prominent TDs. We all knew that, and it was well known, Darren Murphy was working for the European Parliament elections.
Now, go back to the question about attendance, though. Is it okay? Or do we now define attendance of drive-by, used, you know, fob in and then head to the airport? Is that attending the Dáil for a day now? And that's fine.
Well, I think it was Pascal Donoghue who said it. This does throw the whole attendance mechanism for Oireachtas members into a lot of question. But I mean, I don't understand why others who have worse voting records than him have not been subject to any scrutiny in terms of, and some of them are quite prominent TDs.
Yeah, well, if they could be scrutinised, it should be your government that initiate the scrutiny. But I this is an extraordinary story because, and a lot of people feel very bitter of it, least of all Peter McFerry, when he used the example of the Tale of Two Cities. But there's a problem. We fob in, but no time is attached to when you do that. Now, what other workplace does that happen in? When you clock in,
but that must have been deliberately built into the software when that was.
We were deliberately exempted because where I work is I work from office in the Department of Agriculture. So the TD's fobbing in machine is beside a staff fobbing in machine. Their fobbing machine is made by the same company. It gives the times, but they also fob out. We don't have to fob out. We're treated with kid gloves, and it is ridiculously badly set up to allow this sort of, what would you call it, misadventure in the use of our time. And my understanding is if we could get the times of when Darren Murphy fobbed in, didn't fob out, we could probably establish, if we checked it against his flights records to Europe, we could probably establish that he fobbed in on his way to the airport and fobbed in on his way back from the airport.
Okay, now we are speculating because we don't have any hard evidence.
The time, and this has to end.
Yeah, so I know. I just want to be clear there. We do not know exactly because, as we say, the software is set up for us not to know. So we can't say what exactly was. But I think there is a general acknowledgement that Darren Murphy was tweeting from some of the
we do know
capitals of Europe on days when he was attending the Dáil.
Can I say, John?
We
Paul,
do know that
John Paul is a new TD. To me, this is very simple. It's a question about right or wrong, and the difficulty is when a case like Darren Murphy comes up, the immediate line is, "Sure, you're all at it. You're all the same." And I happen to know, I believe politics is a noble profession. Even though I disagree with you on many issues, I know that you're a hardworking politician, as I believe politicians are
in all political parties and are none. But the problem is the body politic is damaged when you have occasions like this, when somebody basically is doing something that they shouldn't do. And it shouldn't be a question about, you know, right or wrong. And I agree, Breed. I mean, I found it very odd. I was given a fob, you know, to start and told, you know, to fob in. I don't have to fob out. I've no problem in terms of my records of where I am in voting and what I do. And I think even the idea of publishing, I'm certainly in favour of publishing TDs' diaries. But I think here is the question, right? Each TD should be accountable for themselves. What Darren Murphy did quite clearly was wrong. I think he should pay back the expenses for that period, because apart from anything else, whether we argue
but,
and
sorry,
in or
but
not,
can I just stop you there, Malcolm?
For European People's Party.
How can we establish what needs to be paid back when we have no way of establishing a record of what was done or not done, or what work that Darren Murphy was doing on the plane to wherever he was flying?
Or his contract with the European People's Party. Let's make that very clear. Prior to the European elections, funnily enough, I was criticising the fact that Darren Murphy was working for the EPP primarily because of the links with Viktor Orban and the work that he was doing there. Could we see a copy of Darren Murphy's contract, for instance? Would he be willing to make...
Well, when we find somebody who's going to do the investigation, we'll get back to that.
I'm
going to have...
There's a committee meeting tomorrow about it, the members' interests.
I have to take a break.
There are other people who have much worse voting records.
I have to take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And I just one question that I'd meant to ask John-Paul Phelan that we just have a few seconds to get a response to. What is your problem with celebrities making their views on homelessness known?
I don't.
I believe that Jim Sheridan has struck back at you for your comments in the Sunday Independent in relation to celebrities. Should basically you were saying get their oar out.
No,
of
I wasn't. I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion. But I mean, the point I was trying to make is that your opinion has to stand up to some level of scrutiny. And even at the time of Apollo House, for example, all of the homeless charities were very questionable, shall we say, about what happened.
Disgraceful remark. It's a very disgraceful remark. Homeless charities were questionable.
No, homeless charities were questioning the message.
Oh, sorry.
You're misunderstanding.
Well, I'm glad we clarified that because on that note, we are going to have to go. I want to thank my panel. I want to thank my team, Brian Lally, Regina Henley, broadcast coordinator Liam Conn, and Harry Buckless was on sound. And now it's over to Colm Murray on Late Date.